Good evening, comrades. You are in tune to Poet Radio on WGXC. My name is Chris, and I'm host of the program. This is the October 2020 edition of Poet Radio. And my guest today is David Jave Johnston, who is a poet and media artist, a scholar, and a wearer of many creative hats, lives in Montreal, and he is with us today via telephone. And Jave, interestingly enough, was going to be my guest, a live guest on the program in March, and then suddenly something happened. A global pandemic happened, and he couldn't come to the United States to attend an event he was going to be at in New York, and we had to postpone this. But I'm very, very glad to have Jave on the program. He's a unique poet who I first knew through his video poems. Actually, I first knew him through his scholarship and a blog that he was creating back in 2007, then through the video poems. And Jave is a programmer, and he created a very interesting sound app online called MUPS, Mashups Pen Sound, which takes many recordings that are available on PenSound and allows the user to remix them together. We will be hearing some of that material. And later on, most recently, Jave has been exploring the potentials of artificial intelligence poetry. And he's just published a book called Rewrites, Human Plus AI Poetry. And that includes 12 volumes of AI poetry that he created and edited over a year's time. Meanwhile, Jave spent some time living in Hong Kong. He produced a book of criticism called Aesthetic Animism, which focuses on digital poetry. So he's a brother of mine in the digital poetics realm. Jave, great to have you here on the program.
Good to be here, yes. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I certainly wish we were able to be sitting across the table from each other and having this conversation that way, but we'll do the best we can. I know that, I introduced you as a video poet, but it seems to me like you really have moved somewhat away from that. I mean, this AI project that you were engaged with was all-consuming, right?
Well, it was all-consuming since 2016, more or less. The first initial deep learning experiments I did arrived because I was fortunate enough to take a fundamentally corporate class in data science. So from data science, perched there amongst the demographic epidemiologists of money, I began to try to use deep learning and the early neural networks to examine poetry. So that became so focused that it did actually take about 3 years to evolve into the completed project. But you know, that's 20-year anniversary of the beginning of NetArt and all the early toys and animations with words. Like everything evolves. So I'm thinking of this as a 20-year cycle for me, like, and for probably many other people as well, because the internet has evolved, right? In 1999, it was this open system where people could use it as a playground, and there was experimentation, and there was public sharing of ideas, and people were allowed to do multiple pop-up windows, and there was no Facebook. There was very little of the corporate control of attention. There was no one talking about dopamine scrolling or artificial intelligence nudging. Instead, it was more like a space of ecstatic creativity where children were probing the limits of a newfound toy. And so that's really where the story begins.
Well, but it's just gotten more and more complex. And I mean, we should...
Oh, yeah.
We'll start with, our conversation here. I think a good place to start is with your most recent work, just because it's really a there's an abundance of material that you were able to produce, co-produce, I suppose I should say, with the AI. And maybe could do a brief introduction to that, and maybe even read some poems if you have them handy.
I do. I could. I can give a bit of an introduction to the entire process. If I tell a story from the human side of things, it's that the algorithms for generating words, for generating language, have transformed radically in the last 5-10 years since the birth of neural networks as a really viable mode of working. So almost everyone kind of knows a little bit about that story because it's been so predominant. But once you begin working with some of those algorithms, you quickly discover that there's a limitation to how much contextually sensitive, really aware poetry they can make, because these are ultimately machines that have not, they have not lived. They do not breathe, they are not born, they do not have a skin. What they understand is the mathematical parameters of patterns within language. So if you feed them a corpus, like as I did by harvesting a lot of the preeminent poetry websites in order to establish a custom-made poetry corpus that wasn't specifically related to the 17th or 18th century, but reflected some of the conceptual interventions that have been more predominant in 20th century and 21st century poetics, and also some of the idiomatic shifts, like words like Facebook and Google and Amazon had different meanings or just didn't even exist in the so-called golden years of the medieval or Renaissance poetry, where Elizabethan scholars tend to position poetry as something that is a traditional practice. So I'm more interested in poetry as a kind of a static practice. And when it's combined with algorithms and code, then it becomes capable to really conjoin the human, flexible, embodied, wet, moist, strangely paradoxical, ambiguous, modular, neurological system of a person, like a person who's ingested a lot of experiences and language. But then that's combined with an algorithm which is just pouring out avalanches of text. So the avalanches of text are invariably not so great. So the moment came after a couple of years of experimenting in 2018 of generating the text raw from these neural networks. The moment came when I realized, oh, I can edit this text. I can actually make a practice. I can make a writing practice out of taking small chunks out of all of these avalanches of text to generate poems which reflect more of the integrity and authenticity of my own embodied life. So that led me to do a year of that, to establish a kind of life practice where from 6 to 8 a.m. every morning for a year, from the spring of 2017 to the spring of 2018, I sat down and edited artificially intelligent generated poetry. The poetry wasn't artificially intelligent, but it was generated by an artificial intelligence. When you begin to cut some of that poetry, you realize how much material, how much beauty is inherent within language itself when it's syntactically aligned and doing idiosyncratic things. It puts in question a lot of the notions of authorship that have sustained us and are permeate our culture. So it was, and also it was just fun to do. Once you discover that the language is sufficient and interesting when it's raw out of the machine, and you begin to edit it, then there's a relationship that develops with the algorithms themselves. So as the year progressed, I would change the diet of both the code, which is kind of like, let's say, the instructions for the recipe, and the diet that's fed to this kind of brain. And the diet is a corpus of words. So the corpus would shift over time. I moved from having a corpus that included Poetry Magazine, Jacket 2, Kappa, ABZ, Shampoo, Two Rivers, a bunch of creative writing seminars. Then I added in a repository of pop lyrics. There was some domains like post-humanism, network text, neurotransmitters, grief work, erotica, that I kind of brought in, blogs and quotations from other academic kind of research that would kind of thicken out the language to make it seem more contemporary. And then the algorithms themselves came from TensorFlow, which is hosted by Google, PyTorch, which was in early beta and hosted by Facebook. And eventually I settled on and was using what's called a quasi-recurrent neural network, which was developed by Salesforce from Facebook's PyTorch algorithm. So all of these different shifts and changes meant that over the year, there was this consistent river, like a huge waterfall of language, which could erupt from the machine because it can write extremely fast. Once it's read the corpus to be trained, it's reading 300 to 600,000 lines. And I would select from about a million lines of poetry that I had gathered. And so as that vocabulary changes, it shifts a little bit. But then it can begin to generate very, very fast. You can get about 100,000 lines of poetry in an hour, working on a fairly decent GPU from that era. So now the human mind is faced by 200,000 lines of poetry that have been generated by a machine. And you want to sit down to think about what is valuable to keep there, what is worth preserving from that reservoir of artificially induced language, which has spewed forth without any consideration of context or nuance or subtlety, or often the emotional grace and continuity of language is absolutely missing. But what is there is a lot of exquisite wordplay. So as you begin to carve, carving is slow. It's like the art of a craftsperson. So as you cut away the text, there's this combination of a very high-tech calibrated mode of reasoning, which is operating from the corporate level of the algorithm, from the net spiders which have gone out to collect the corpus. But then the body is there. It's the morning. The internet is off. And I find that I'm actually in a kind of contemplative, slow, dense, steady mode. And it's an exquisite joy. And an extraordinary opportunity to, instead of be sitting there with an empty mind, which an empty mind is a wonderful thing, but to actually have an empty mind, but also be in the presence of this languaged substrate, which you can just modulate. It's like being given a reservoir of material that is just inexhaustible. And it's what I refer to as the inexhaustible muse. And after doing that for a year, I truly do think that not many writers in the next century, if humanity survives, and that seems to be the large question of our species, if we choose to not eradicate each other and everything else, then it's highly probable that all of us will write with external augmentation.
Well, I think that's increasingly happened over time, right? There may be a few pure poets out there who resist using technology. But increasingly in this century, you know, poets are, even if they're using like a search engine or something to locate something, that's informing their thought patterns or their, you know, their what they end up writing, right? So, I mean, their famous cases like Flarf, of course, but, you know, I think most poets are, you know, relying on technology in a way that, you know, that it makes an impact on their practice. I wanted to mention, I don't know if you would remember this, but once upon a time, I saw you doing some live editing of this material. I believe it was at the Electronic Literature Organization Festival a couple of years ago. You did it on stage. You were doing a demonstration. And I mean, that was marvelous to watch because it was like you were... almost like a musician picking out the notes to play. You know, you were like, we got a sense, the audience that evening, of a flow. It's not like you were laboring intensely, painstakingly over every line. It was pretty quickly, you know, rhythmic and all this other, you know, these components. It was on this, it was very spontaneous, which I, you know, which I appreciate. And it goes, somebody else, another poet editing the same material would come up with something completely different, which is an interesting idea as well. So in a way, this cyborgian practice, you know, is something that becomes your own in the end, don't you think?
It's very much malleable. So that when I've taught this in a couple workshops now, and people, when they approach the same mountain of words, will filter it, change it, shift it, and make it their own. They ingest it, they digest it, they become the sort of operative conditioning that mutates that form. So it's fascinating that this seeming, this sense of the words, for me, it's almost like a mountain where there's a momentum. And the more you just let the momentum carry you down the page, picking out your path, the more fun it is, the more your mind just kind of ricochets against the semantic moguls or shapes or forms. And there's this sense of this inexorable joy that seizes the mind when it realizes that the material is endless, that there is just essentially this abundance at the foundation of everything. So in the classroom, students will do amazing structurally independent, very, very attuned work that reflects their identities. So it's not that the excess imposes an identity on the other. It's that the identity is able to burrow into it, to do a conversion, a transmutation, a transformation of that sort of primordial excess. That, as if language itself was finally given a sort of elemental velocity, as if it was just freed from the constraints of being born in a human mind, as we understand it. Though there was a recent research study, this like in the last couple of weeks, which showed that primates will actually recognize what are called non-adjacent symbols. So there's grammatically correct symbols which kind of float through morphemes and structures like that. But primates will actually, they're neurologically responding differently to things that are adjacent versus non-adjacent. So this suggests that the origins of language, the origins of sound as symbolic communicative structure is ancient. And that contradicts a lot of the known idea that we are the sole carriers of this, a form given to us by God or some strangeness. It really does feel like it's like an evolutionary field that has sprouted inside physiognomy. And so now it's been born and it's gone off and been digested again by these massive corporate brain structures that are designed to, you know, extrapolate which way they can manipulate us so that more commodities fly out of the factories. And instead, the language itself can be reborn somewhere that's not yet culturally sufficient to be considered compelling, yet with a bit of care, it is like having a quarry or being given an enormous empty book back in the Middle Ages. And it does remind me that dictionaries and all that stuff, that's all technology anyway. I think we were always kind of in this hybrid augmented state as soon as we became literate.
Yeah, right. And language, I love that phrase you use, the language having an elemental velocity. And so it joins forces, you know, with a human mind. And
it does require a certain energy. After a year, I haven't gone back to it. Like in that year, I wrote 4,500 poems, approximately. I think it was just a little bit under. And that's well beyond the range, I think, of kind of, it doesn't say that the poems are good or that they're they're valid, or that they're viable, or that they really challenge the a much different practice. I still believe that there's such a diversity in the ecosystem of creative practices that we have to be responsive and open to the capabilities of other beings to work in whatever modality they choose. But in this particular modality, it suggests very strongly that for specific kinds of minds, there is now an unprecedented augmentation of the capacity to be capable of expounding in a literary way. Like, I think the process of working like that makes it really clear that we were never really the authors of these things anyway. A human being ingests language from the moment of its birth through its parents, its families, its communal structure. It's just absorbing. And that absorption awakens all of the generative grammars and the potentialities available across the morpheme stream and the spectrum and everything. But then suddenly you've got another amazing kind of opening where all of that language can sprout and grow outward and come out of the body. So right now, is the baby, is the child actually producing a creative output, or are they simply what in the words of some AI researchers, are they reward optimized machines? And I'm moving more and more to this perspective that a human organism is simply a compounded evolutionary structure which is given a symbolic reservoir, and from that symbolic reservoir of language, it is induced to produce. And what we consider to be creativity is actually just the articulate froth at the periphery of personalities.
It seems to me that the whole process, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that you haven't gone back to it, because it's very attention intensive, right? I mean, I think the idea that you have to, going back to it every day as yourself, and having to try to, I mean, I don't think, that coherence is really the thing that you're after, but in order to like maintain any kind of focus, that's highly demanding, right? And if you created over 4,000 poems in a year, I mean, that's a lot of attention to language, and you probably needed a little time off from that.
Also, there's another aspect that I think is maybe there's a personal aspect that, you know, if I go back 20 years, I did a one-year project making flash animations. And then I've always been in love with Sam Hsieh's work, right? Hsieh-Ching, like the one-year project performance artist whose work is just so astonishing, right? Yeah, I think it's among the most important work in the 20th century art canon is there, because it extends the boundaries of everything that's to be alive as an artist. So that idea of the one-year project kind of, I had absorbed it from there and I adopted it 20 years ago. So when I began the writing project, Carving the AI, I kind of knew in advance that I would follow that script. And then there's the non-personal kind of motivation for not continuing, is that the algorithms of deep learning and neural networks, and even the idea of attention, these have extrapolated a kind of line of potential which was around when they first won the ImageNet competitions, whether it was it in 2007 or 2010, I don't remember, but now there's, once that was established that you can actually do unsupervised learning using a feed-forward, feed-backward, recursive derivative process within nodes by modulating the weights and biases, so you have a sense of the topological pattern of a language space. Once that is known, the algorithms are just being refined, but the core principle of how they work has not shifted. And it's obvious to me that the artificial intelligence we have now is extraordinarily potent, but it is not anything or it's not anything equivalent to a human body, nor is it close to having a lived sense of experience, nor is it aware of what it means to fall in love or to fall sick or to die or to grieve or any of that. It has no understanding of any of that. We have an AI which is brittle and small. It's very capable at subduing populations or proving to be a authoritarian capitalism or surveillance communism or whatever acronyms you want to grow out of it. It can be manipulated for massive profit, and it can be manipulated for extraordinary cultural uses, but it's still not anywhere near saying, oh yeah, we've got a robot artist who's working here. He's a great complex guy, you know, or a woman or a Zay or whatever. Like this is still a daydream. And the algorithms haven't changed from when I stopped doing the project in 2018. They have modulated and there's been improvements, but the same as the carburetor and the combustion engine, the principle of those structures, it's initiated at the beginning and then it just kind of continues onward.
Is this a rewrites volume, which is was published, also published this year, last year, by Antiism Books. It's fantastic. And I guess the other question that I wanted to ask you is, like, if you have been, you know, criticized for, you know, by the poetry community or anything, anybody has gotten in your face about how dare you type commentary. Take the beauty, take the, you know, the sensitive poetry medium and subject it to like this cold and calculated processes.
Yeah. I think the people who are not interested in it, who actually physically dislike it, have been kind enough to not talk to me directly. It takes a certain energy to get, you know, where would they find me? They'd have to write me an email or something. You know, in most of the places I've exhibited it, well, people just, if they don't like it, they'll just walk by. And I don't think it's going to elicit the sense of, you know, man, that's, but like there's that sense. I was going to say the joke of, boy, that's going to take away our jobs soon. But maybe underneath it, there is that sense in the poetry community that there's really not enough financial support in the world to really sustain all of us. And very, very, what's the percentage of poets who actually live from their writing? I'd say that's a very, very small percentage. So there is kind of that fear of scarcity, of here, why would we do this with this? Like if I were to critique it myself, it's a sense, like why bother exploring with this stupid machine that produces a kind of like language salad garbage? Why bother playing with it? And, you know, because you're just destroying people's capacity to read what might be valuable, what might be overlooked. All of the sensitive, delicate, wonderful poetry that's written on a daily basis by people who are going through processes that are emotional and physical and financial and social and cultural and political and all those, the endless litany of different vibratory registers that instigate creative language acts in people maybe it's threatened by these massive machines. But my feeling right now is that it's not a real threat. It's right now it's an opportunity. And that seems to be the dilemma with all of humanity's engagement with technology, is that we perceive things as threats when actually they're opportunities. Artificial intelligence is an opportunity to feed everyone and to move the entire world over onto renewable, sustainable energy systems. It's an opportunity to explore the material engineering space in order to discover new formulas and chemical instantations which will replace all plastics. It's an opportunity to mutate the genome in ways which are potentially beneficial. But all of those opportunities are also flipped over and become threats, because we are a particularly pernicious, controlling, power-freak species of predators. And that's maybe the major problem. It's the meta problem that's the problem, not the poetry problem. You know, I'm just as ignored as a normal poet, you know. Really, there's very little interest in this work at all. So I'm very grateful that we're doing a radio show here, Chris. And I'm grateful you wrote an essay for this little segment of essays that went into the volume, which was done specifically to see if I could generate a little bit more interest about the project, but also because I felt it was a viable, valid marker in the history of augmented literature, where a human works with machine. And we both know that example of Charles Hartman, who is like the sort of primordial genius at the basis of that work, of a poet writing actively with a machine as an active collaborator. But what's different here is these neural networks are much more prolific. The rule systems are not enforced by a programmer. In fact, it's statistical regularities that they're finding within the pattern set of language. They're not following a rule system so much as they're flowing down gradients. So it's all about gradient descent and minima and maxima. So that's a cluster of what I've thought.
Well, in case the readers are interested, is the Rewrites book available? Is it being distributed, I know there's a website for Antiism, but can this book, which contains some raw output, some edited output?
Yep,
that's a real thing. It can be bought online. The Rewrites raw outputs essay paperback is we'll add a link, I suppose. Can you add a link on a radio show? Is it possible? Like, is there some way that we could convert a voice into like a QR code so that we would make a sound and everyone's phone would just pop out to a browser?
The essays in the book are by Allison Parrish, Joanna Drucker, Kyle Booten, John Cayley, Laetzi Fahn, Nick Mumford, Mayreid Byrne, and myself. It's a nice little collection. You know, I think it'd be, if you don't mind spending giving us like a 5 minute to end this part of a segment of the program, maybe you could read some of the poems. We've talked about them for a long time. So I think it'd be great to have a recitation.
Okay, I'll read a poem from February, which is page 67. It's just, it's a random choice. Just, I don't even have a set of the books. So I'm reading it from a video I made of flicking through the InDesign file. And the poem is entitled, "I am the nothing you believe in and a sea of invisible love. I'm the shadows walking in the sand, the dreams of the dead world. A litter of perfume falling into the sea, a pawn in a tree, where the clouds die of light, singing isolation, acetylene beautiful. A place reflecting a memory that cannot hide, a suspended penetration. Dark sounds as the sky fills night with the living dead light, the short game of peace, like a house alone." So that's one of the edited poems, right? That's one of the edited poems. So it's because this video of that February work is 1 minute and 30 seconds long, do you want to just give me a number between like 1 and 60 or 1 and 90? And then I'll choose that time on the timeline, just so that we can say that we're not cherry picking.
34, John.
Okay, so this is from Rewrites, February Flick Through. It's on Vimeo. This is 34. Let me pull it specifically over. I'm on 35, 34. Here we are. Okay. So there is a force sleeping in the beginning of hot blue petals, trotting up the road to cut throats. It is in the heart of the ground, a salt heaving around rocks, writing mad signs. Night bought it and turned the hills into darkness and sold the sea. Its grief is a moss that drips red, writhing dew, a mind-bogglingly soft and wise blob of grift. So there's two poems. Should we read one more?
Please, yes.
I'm going to read 108, because that's where my cursor has fallen. Okay. So 108, there's two short poems here. A child drinking water. The real tip gesture cast a smooth, beautiful kiss. A lean light sang in love's paradigms, from peace to disorder, and beyond where the grass is, or fog or snow broken in your bed, an ovoid sutra dismantling anxious tautness, embeddings to shuck meaning, duress inside plastic endorphins. So there we have it, page 245 of February Rewrites. We're going to leave Rewrites pretty soon. Should we have a peek at GPT-2 before we go? There's an extreme beauty inherent within a lot of the language before I even begin to play with it. You know, I can take some credit for just like a carpenter sanding a piece of wood, or a craftsperson approaching a structure and delineating a potential form. But there's such beauty already there. Like here's one little piece which I've totally kind of not touched yet. A room which lies patiently in ritornelles of overturned misdoubt. Pre-replicated, self-maintained, redistributed, hypersensitive, spray-painted. These kind of catalogs emerge from the kind of entrails of the unknown browsers, the thrust of incurious flesh sent along pathological rivers to scratch what doesn't exist. It accepts all things, all the self, whole trees of it stuck into the apricot skin. So now I'm reading from the stuff that I was cutting. And now I'm cutting the circle headache, the wasp bridges, the terms of speared capricious sandstone, the judgment windmills and bodies, the prescriptions where everyone comes quickly everywhere, and summer silk waits, a unity of medulla granting tinder neat desire, nook pillows denoting wet limbs. And this can go on forever. We are like unimaginable lovers, dazed with tranquility, traveled not thinking in a paradise of vibrant memory, clean where organic decisions develop deep basilar compulsion pyramids, a blueprint of meaning marked as squirming death and beauty, earth, herb motel, sheep, immediate, grade, initiate, highways. Does it make sense? Does it hold? Does it have that sort of incarnate ending that we associate with poetry? Sometimes. But in its play, in its diversity of lexicon, in its swaying sort of slippery world, we perceive something that could be on the peripheries of being sentient. And language itself, the more we scrutinize it, feels to me, this is like our essential substrate, some sort of field of our articulation, is actually carrying sentience along. And it's related to how signs and symbols are moved within bloodstreams and between beings. And so this is just an experiment to see how far we can telepathically induct ourselves into the pseudonym drowned entropy loam glycerins of Web 2.0 ringtones. You know, the knit synonym celibacy hawks. There's something about, like, I've thought about being able to talk about the flowing curve of drifting ground, the sewage diaphragm. And it's possible to think of yourself as some sort of entropy loam. To use the poem itself as just a seeding system. So now, that could go on for a long time.
I'm digesting my thinking of myself as an entropy loan. And did you say that there's some of this is on Vimeo? Is that right?
Well, as we approach the graveyard, the what do they call this? The death of Flash? I'm in the midst of actively screen capturing all of the Flash-based work that I made over the last 20 years. And in order to save it from extinction in a very reduced format. Though I do actually believe that there will be emulators within the sort of computational archaeology labs that are going to sprout up, like Laurie Emerson's work in Boulder. Many people will develop ways to preserve this material, but its capacity to be diffused widely, to be played with, and especially when it's things that are heavily coded and dependent on live, dynamic pulling in of files, all of this is gone. It's going to disappear, and the support for it's going. So I am building what amounts to a playlist of 20 years of work. So that's on Vimeo, and soon it's on the front page of my website as well. And I'm thinking of it. It's also an opportunity for me to say, oh, this entire set of work, this entire playground with digital technology is over. Huh. And then we can get into something really serious, which is maybe tangential to where you might want to take the conversation. But I'm fundamentally moving away from digital technology at this point. I think that the use of digital technology, the openness of the internet, which was part of its joy in the beginning, is now swiftly dissipating as the monopoly of platforms and the sort of predatorial surveillance capitalism displaces what was formerly sort of the green commons, the open ecological nexus of people playing. And so more and more I feel that the attention economy has permeated all of us. And inexorably, that kind of notification-based gratification of dopamine, RAFE nuclei systems, which are in their feedback processes, very vulnerable to subtle, insidious nudging. So I'm saying, okay, well, what's the next step? What is the next path for a poet? And I don't believe that for me at this time, it's through continuing to learn every new programming language and tinkering with software and buttons and trying to keep my skills upgraded. I'm actually going to step way back from computers after I've wrapped up this little 20-year digital poetry party of my personal progress. I'm going to wrap it up. I'm going to put it onto an SSD. I'm going to sell it to the maybe between 2 to 7 libraries that might be interested. That's my guess. And then I'm going to retire. And I'm going to work on the sort of primordial process of becoming a poet at the physiological level. And I'm going to go silent. That's my new ground. Because right now we're in an excess of words, and the words are usually controlled and they're weaponized. So I believe that the recall to the interior silence is the next, the only potential space of protest against the universe, which appears to be more and more insane.
So Jave, you did mention your website in there, and I think it'd be a good idea to tell the listeners that it's glia.ca. That's correct, right?
That's correct. And I think it's important to remind the listeners, because it's an aside, but neurologically, your neuroglia is your immune system of the brain. And so it's pulling out the toxins. It's implicated in Alzheimer's. And there's the glymphatic system, where a lot of these porous membranes at the blood-brain barrier are actively trying to transduce the impact of toxins, remove dead cells, and nourish the neuronal tissue. So that's what I see glia as. It's a space where literature can be nourished inadvertently by interventions that appear to come from outside the space of traditional book culture. It is an extended experiment in what happens if you actually welcome the computer into creative literary practice.
I'm glad we had this lengthy conversation about rewrites. I didn't imagine that we would spend so much time on it, because I really was excited to introduce to listeners to your MUPS project, the Mashups Pen Sound. But I think we're going to do that now for, you know, to conclude the program. We have touched on a lot of, you know, different aspects of your work, but here we are at the end of the era of Flash, the software program, which is going to be discontinued permanently, inaccessible as of January 2021. I mean, even now it's very difficult. You have to use a Chrome browser and et cetera to see any Flash work. But you did do amazing work with Flash in this one sound poetry project you did, the Mashup Pen Sound. It's phenomenal. I mean, it's a great loss. And, you know, we could go on and on about how uncool it is that, you know, this is happening. But rather than do that, could you briefly introduce what you were doing with MUPS? And we'll conclude the program by playing some MP3s of that project.
The MUPS mashup project arose because I was in love with Pen Sound, right? The Pen Sound poetry audio archive, which you're affiliated with them. And there's so many exquisite poetic works there. But at that time, in order to listen to them, you would click from the author page over to the audio, and then the audio page would have a list of these little audio files, and you could start them and you could listen to one at a time, and then you would have to go back to the central archive and maybe find another poet. And I've always, perhaps it's a disability, but I've had a very let's say energetic consciousness, in terms of I love to have a multiplicity of experiments and explore how conjunctions arise between different things. I like to do like side-by-side analysis. So I wanted to hear different poets speaking at the same time. I wanted to see how their voices interweave. I wanted to actually see more of these poems there. I wanted to know how large was that website. So I actually went and kind of downloaded as many of the MP3s as I could find through using a bot. And then I built a system in Flash where it would just let me play them. So that's how it began. I just had a big grid of little black squares, and those black squares were all play buttons, and I could just start as many poems as I wanted. And then I realized I wanted to hear them talking to each other, having a conversation. And Flash has so many interesting capacities that unfortunately are very, very difficult to replicate within the browser now using HTML5. And maybe that's another conversation, but some of that is due to again, to come back to the weaponizing of the internet. So that now browsers need to be secured. Browsers are places where people do banking. So we can't have small little files which make byte arrays out of like passwords or things. But in the Flash era, you could create what's called a byte array. And the byte array means that you can analyze a waveform of a sound file. And analyzing the waveform, I was able to find and set noise thresholds. So I could look for silence. And when you find silence within a sound or within a poet speaking, when they stop, then you can start another file. And when they stop, you can start another. So this is a way of articulating a cut, a dynamic editing of the voice that respects word boundaries to most in some degree. And in some sense, I really think it's, so I called that process, in the same way that with the AI, I called the process carving, I called this process weaving. And I do think it's kind of like a very rudimentary kind of weaving, because it's able to weave many different poets, and it's able to set the threshold for that silence, and it sets the number of times that it encounters silence before it moves to the next person, and it sets the hoped for length of sound signal. So you can set it very, very short, so you're arriving at kind of like the morpheme chop of Ursinat and B.P. Nichol and all Paul Dutton and the numerous other people who've done sound poetry to create sort of the jumbling of all the vocalese. Or you can listen to poets talk just as they are. It can be just a plain radio station. And it's 1,260 audio poems from the archives that were used eventually, gratefully, with permission, due to the generosity of Charles Bernstein and one Christopher Funkhauser.
Seeing the initial like beta versions of this, I found to be very inspiring. It influenced my work, so it worked. It was a reciprocal thing that happened there, and it still remains to me. I'm hoping that someday there is a way to replicate what you've done with that project, because like, this morning, I was listening, I think I mentioned this to you, I was listening to a combination of Helen Adam and Kathy Acker, and it was like, it was so beautiful, in this idea of like juxtaposing, you know, the voices of others. Or for me, one of my interests in the interactive audio work that I've done is like pairing discrepant poets and sound files, or musicians, like, things can arise or emerge out of these pairings or triplings or however many. I mean, you can play 100 poets' voices at the same time, and you know, it might end up being a din at a certain point, but there might be that one eureka moment where something magical emerges. We will close out the program today playing some collages from the MUPS project. I wish we had more time, Javi, because I'm sure we could continue this conversation. But the constraint of radio is it's an hour long, so we're going to have to end it here. You and I will have to converse more about these subjects anon.
It's been lovely talking. Thank you very much, Chris.
It's called The Exhaustion of Libraries.
Translated myself.
Adenoidal Alexander,
some of them
brachiatic
I translated from a book called Musée de l'Os et de l'Eau.
Fiercely grinding gravitation, hopeless teeming integration. Inner jocularities,
Rumi says,
Django,
it is
Kavanaugh.
Always the season in which they are painting navies.
Lockstep lexicography,
there was
not
only
necrophagy.
Just a single
note,
a twist of tears, moving along the cheek,
crispy
hours of sentence.
Signifiers, signs.
Other poems came.
Had
a question of the origin of existence meant meaning is floating.
X.
Au loin,
Rumi says it
had
to
do solitude.
Combat, victory.
Words,
also
indeed, there was no solution. Just
such
a liquid story, a sharp suspense. So you said, pointing at a throat.
We call this field of corpses.
You pretend not to notice.
Its metal is iron.
Time in a key lime pie.
Rubric
the sweetness of clouds.
Red
a refined past and present surrounding you.
Sea foam.
And other words
physical
clay.
It is called hay boo
solid. This makes a con.
Now you wander about the idea of mouths filled with
plain substance
of the
dress. To the other dress,
the way one runs,
the recurrent dress,
the perpetual
dress,
the lifestyle that one
does
not exist, the punctuation of flowers, the lines,
the
lines,
the
lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines, the lines,
It's only the white page, it's faint.
Proper citizen. Waste.
Young men of.
And.
You.
Lateness. The motion is.
Not.
In unlike.
The virgin.
You.
Frame of.
Writ. You.
A pig.
Or kneel.
Red.
You. Say. I.
Meaning.
Devised in ornamental open work.
Dress.
Which requires.
Your rip.
Service of.
The animals.
Bulls and eight.
Four fingers.
A mute.
You need not.
You hear the violas.
You roll.
Or more.
All culture.
Death.
Lion.
Macrest.
Bird.
What? Or move.
Hard.
Beyond. And.
Are loaded.
All cultures. I dream.
Are.
On this.
Germany.
A woman.
Guilds.
Time.
You.
Things.
I dream of a time.
Fighting.
Cultures.
Dreaming.
The
lovely Mrs. Valent.
Black and white tile.
Four.
Burns Ubu.
Your need is sex also. Your head is face
in infraction. Rugged riot shoots.
Illusions in the artery.
Reply that.
Just having a lair.
Why you are.
Thus Ubu.
West to sun.
Come on, snake eyes.
Historical dress.
Drinks makes you.
Dead. Miles.
The greens. And craps out, forget.
Hardened.
Happens frequently.
Seated.
Speechless and languid. Not smokers. And poison.
Happens.
Go. Goo.
Pay for me in bed.
Speechless fractionators. Ivy.
Efficiently. In a.
Gig. Gag.
I could.
And whirl about. But which. Mulch and miracle.
Explicit instances.
Chemical foreplay.
Plunge jackknife into.
Peer transport. Grow ahead.
In the works of X.
Prematurely.
Your heart right now.
Not stationary. Mites. Slug me.
The dress.
Simeon.
Body in hand.
Anywhere. Are. Spray Nash.
The other.
Alphaville. Soft.
Flat. Open.
Yet. Shittalize. Which way to
dress?
Boiled. Scalp.
Arms down.
Simeon sibs. Helicon fly.
The necessary dress.
Confetti.
While legs cross.
Vast on cold. Hybrid slash wild.
The con.
Let's go watch.
You and I like.
They royal audibly drip. Avenging stamens. Inflamed like.
Tingent dress. For the.
Cells divide.